Well, hello. Good afternoon. 4 o'clock on a Saturday. Do you know what? I've been living for this Saturday, Dave. The weather has been incredible. So lucky you if you've if you've been able to enjoy it and if you're a place to enjoy it. If not, when it's all over, come to Devon and buy houses in Devon because Devon's great. What's it like where you are, Dave? Are you able? Do you have actually grass where you live and stuff?
Yeah, we have little bits of grass. And most of it's in bags and sold for £10. But
I love it.
It's absolutely glorious here today.
Oh, it is. And the dearest family have just they've just locked all the doors and shut me in here. Well, I'm now going to get more and more hot, no doubt, because. Yeah, because they're saying, well, we don't want to disturb you and you can, because you talk quite loudly because you've got an earphone in sort of thing. So
anybody who knows you, Harry, will know that that's rubbish. Harry talking.
I'm quite shy and retiring. This is just a facade. Yeah. I'm miserable inside. You know that. So we've got lots of lovely people coming. So it's really good to see. We've got June Word. We've got Noxandra. Nice. We've got Jackie Stevens. Gabby's Gran. Loved to see Gabby's Gran. Hi, Dave and Harry from Liverpool. Lovely. There's a picture of Finn. That's even better than anything else. And I've got to introduce him. I'm not going to introduce him yet because I want to catch up with what you've been doing, Dave, because you're the only one catching criminals out of the two of us right now. But we have got a bit of a visitor today. And, we hope so.
Yeah.
But we'll say a little bit more about him in a minute because I think most people know and that's why they're here. It's not for us. But, mate, what have you been up to? Because I could tell you what I've been up to, but it'd probably be quite short.
Yeah. I've had a few days off, so it's been really nice. Been at home with the family. They are here today, but they've all gone out because I moaned at them last week for using the interwebs whilst we were doing this. And you lost me for a little while, which was probably a good thing, to be fair. It's all been good this end. Should I do the news?
Do the news, but before you do the news, I've got to say we've got a very royal visitor today, and if you look at the screen there, Moira T, Mrs. Tangi, she is my mother, and she is the loveliest mother in the world to me, and she is more royal than the Queen, Mum, aren't you? And really good to see you. And then Tonya Tangi is my sister, who's really caring for her. Because Mum, you're the other side of 52, aren't you? So, but enjoy it. Hopefully it goes right. But I think we need to establish the news here, don't we? So what's going on?
So first of all, I just want to ask everybody if you could just share what you're watching now. So if you're on Facebook, share the post to your timeline. If you're on Twitter or Periscope, then please share it to your timeline. So it's been quite quiet in the news, hasn't it, this week? There's not been a lot going on. I mean, the news has been pretty boring. There's been a few lost cats. There was a cat stuck up a tree down in the south somewhere. But other than that, we've really struggled with news. Harry hasn't been involved in any news stories at all, which is a shock. But it was a story.
Well, in fairness, I did, but carry on. Yeah.
We hated the news. There was a story that the Federation chair, John Aptus, shared this week, and that was about a guy who's been up in court for the fifth time having attacked emergency workers, and yet he still managed to avoid jail, which I know something John is working on really hard, and, you know, that just beggars belief. How can you be up in court for the fifth time and nothing happens to you again? What sort of message does that send? Finn's Law Scotland. Boom. Finn's Law Scotland passed through the second stage, the committee stage, and it's now on to its third and final stage. And if that all goes well, it looks like Finn's Law Scotland will come into power in the autumn. So thanks to the Scottish Parliament, to Liam Kerr and all the people.
But no small thing, because you started off in the UK. People know with the Finn's Law. Explain in 10 seconds, just in case they don't know.
Police, dogs and horses in this country were not protected under law if they were attacked. So prosecutors were left with a difficult choice of not prosecuting or finding something else that didn't match. And Finn's Law changed that. It's now an offence.
And Dave, you're a bloody hero and you need a gong, mate, because it's ridiculous that you haven't. You've put so much to this. You've put your, and I know your own expense, toil, you're through, you're you're on your fifth wife now, aren't you? Or is it the first wife?
I'm very lucky. My first wife is absolutely incredible. She's had to put up with a lot over the last 3 years, and she still does. I say 3 years, 20 years she's put up with a lot.
And since put up with you, but yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So just a couple more bits. I've got to give this a plug. The Thin Blue Law, Thin Blue Poor Foundation, get that right, Thin Blue Poor Foundation, a new charity launched this week by me and a friend, and it looks to plug the gap for the forces that don't, the 27 or so forces out of 43 that don't have a charity for their retired police dogs, and there's a whole host of other stuff we're going to do. But, Harry.
Yes.
I do need to make an apology on your behalf.
Oh, good. I like apologies. Can I savour this one? Is it worth savouring, or is it? Oh, hang on. Is this a trick?
I'm saying this is a trick.
Yeah. Hang on. I've had this before. I'll end up being more apologetic than you with this. I know, well, but go on.
I'll finish this. There's absolutely no excuse for Harry's behaviour this week on social media. I need to find the post if I can.
Oh, no.
Sorry, mate. It's probably done.
Go on, do it.
Harry's always very vocal on social media. And there's something that I'm going to struggle from having seen this week. And I'm sure you all saw it. And I can only apologise. I do need to show you this.
Oh, hang on.
There's no excuse for that, Harry.
I have covered both nipples there. So I thought that was before the 9 o'clock threshold. Okay.
Not now, though, is it?
And no, in fairness, no one's looking at my book and the book I'm reading, which might just happen to be by our special guest today, who I can see looking in the green room. I can see you, and no one else can see you, John. So just help yourself to all the drinks that we've laid out in the green room there for you, John. And you got Dave's mug. I've got some. It's not gin and tonic. It's water that I've just spilled on my laptop. We got loads of visitors and things. I've just checked. We're bang up to 150 live viewers already. So really, really good. But I mean,
no one here, Harry.
Yeah. No, I did think you were referring to a certain person tweet that I put. I was just a little bored, and oh my god, it just created hellfire. So if you know, there's so many people who get this is Twitter is their world and Facebook is their world, and if anyone says anything that is remotely different from what they're thinking, and so yeah, I do get a bit bored, and I just put a small incendiary device into something, and it did. Honestly, do you know what the weird feeling is? Right, is since leaving the job, I had that same feeling in my stomach, thinking, "Oh God, I'm going to be in the shit on Monday."
About what you're doing on social media.
No.
So, who's not sure what Harry's talking about? Harry might have made a comment about a certain person in the UK and their travel arrangements during the lockdown.
It was the actual video. It was the video, wasn't it, of all the press outside. Yeah. Mr. Cummins's house, and there's one, isn't it, where all the press are covered in red and all that, and he is in green, and it says one of these colors is complaining about the other one breaching social distancing, you know, they're all crammed. I mean, the hypocrisy is amazing. And yeah, and this is not the place, we're not the politics and all that, but I might have thrown in a comment like, you know, this is the press and all that, it's slightly, you know, there's today's press or a lot of them or some of them or whatever. I says, however, I can't see what he's done wrong personally. Oh, my God.
That leads us on to our guest. So you call a bomb an explosion, and this guy's used to bombs and explosions.
Wow. Oh, my God. Okay, right. We've got it. I'm going to introduce him as a picture first to say this guest coming in at the moment is John Nicol. He should be a Sir John Nicol, shouldn't he, really? But John Nicol, okay, so he's flight lieutenant, the RAF, as a navigator in a Tornado jet, the most beautiful plane in the world, I think. He's a veteran of Desert Storm and the Gulf War, and was shot down and tortured by the Iraqis. And he's one of the most endearing images of the war was he and John Peters, his pilot, being paraded in front of the television, having been tortured. And we've got press, you know, of that shortly for just to remind people. He's a writer of many best-selling books. He's included Tornado Down, which is this one here, which is just, if you want an account of really getting you there and feeling what someone feels when they don't know what's 10 minutes down the line, whether they're going to be alive or not, is just phenomenal. That's, you need to read that book. Latterly, he's written Spitfire, which is the penultimate one towards the one here. This, it contains an awful lot about my dad, Nigel Tanguy's photo reconnaissance. So I am forever indebted for him to have so many things about him in there, along with many other pilots and ground crew and things. It's just such an adventure to read. And then, of course, the final one that we're going to be talking about, the latest one, I should say, not the final one, is now Lancaster, the forging of a very British legend. But he's a speaker, he's a journalist, and he's an author. And I just want to ask so many things about it, because I've just finished that. I've read it. You can see it's a little bit worn around the edges and things, because I've read it wherever I've been, and I've finished it last night late. So no further introduction apart from to say, John Nicol, lovely to see you. How are you? Lovely
good
to see you, my
gentlemen.
Friend.
How are you, gents?
Very good.
I'm so much better now.
You only live down from me, and I see you all the time, but I'm really, really excited about this.
Well, that just says more about your life than anything
really
else does. if chatting to me on a video is the peak of your excitement for the weekend, you need to get out a bit more, pal.
Yeah, Dave.
John, yesterday, he and I were like giggling schoolgirls.
I wasn't. John, to be honest, mate, I didn't want you. I wanted my librarian from down the road. I wasn't really that bothered. You know,
he'd
I'm pretty cool
about it. More
interesting
than me. Can I just say, but especially for this podcast or whatever you call the damn thing, I bought 140 quid's worth of Galaxy earbuds. Can I get them to work? Can I hell get them to work? I've got no idea it is the most expensive plastic box in the history of the human race.
Well, I won't tell you what my customers would use that thing for now. It's not full of earbuds. Can I not ask, weren't you once in charge of the most technologically advanced fighter bomber in the world? And you can't use a headphone.
Well, to be fair, I could, but about 30 seconds before you went live, they disconnected, and there's a message keeps flashing up. You can't see it, but it's just there. Yeah. It says, can't connect to Galaxy earbuds, can't connect to Galaxy earbuds. And I would have to, I don't know, dismantle my phone.
John, what you need to do is just keep it pressed, mate, until it goes beep, beep. I have just had, because I've just retired recently in the last 3 weeks, that nobody probably knows about. But I've just updated the TV, the speakers that are about 1,000 years old. And I have just spent the morning trying to get the surround sound speakers to work. And my 21-year-old son just walked in and went, and then he went, and then works absolutely fine. So thank you, Rowan, for that.
No, Tornado Down was just, it was just like one page, wasn't it? It was John pressed the wrong button. We ended up upside down.
No, that's a contentious thing. It's a question, isn't it?
Still asked 30 years on. People still ask that question and still slag me off. No, they do. You know what it's like. All you did was got shot down. And intrinsically, they're absolutely right, because all I did was got shot down. But, you know, people still bring that up 30 years down the line.
You say that, I have to argue that, because when you read Tornado Down, and I read this version, the paper out there, and most people would have, or a lot of people would have just crumbled. And that's some of the questions that we want to ask you is what is your mindset? How did you get through the net? Did you think, right, I've got to get through this week, or is it get through this 5 minutes? And then you're listening to your mates getting tortured, and you're pretty much saying, God, I hope they kill them, because they are in misery and things like this. And you don't know if you're going to be there in 5 years' time. That is just
Yeah, but I think it's one of those things that people talk about. They say, oh, you were really brave, or oh, what you did was incredible. And I always say, and it's really important. So first of all, the point is that all I did was got shot down and sat on my fat ass for 7 weeks. There's no doubt about that.
You know, you are so modest.
But lots of my friends, I've just, you know, I don't know. You said you finished the Lancaster book, Harry.
Yes,
so if you've got to the very last page, you'll get an idea about what the next book is going to be.
And so I'm so excited. Yes.
I've spent the last 4 months talking to my mates from 30 years ago, who were flying those ops day after day, and we hadn't really spoken about it before. And what they went through was astonishing. And so I completely understand the notion that all you did was got shot down. But when people say, oh, it was heroic, or oh, you are incredible, I always say, and this is not a joke, and I'm not downplaying it, the reality is that I did nothing exceptional. To do something heroic is to do something exceptional in the face of adversity. You guys know a lot about that in your day-to-day jobs.
No, I didn't do anything.
I did nothing exceptional. What I did, and I sat down and I existed amidst adversity. I had adversity meted upon me. I didn't have any choices to make. I couldn't say, I don't want this to happen, or I don't, you know, none of those things mattered. Control had been taken out of your hands completely, and whatever was going to happen was going to happen, and I could do nothing about it.
So are you saying that the alternative was just to crack up and have a nervous breakdown?
No,
that's
not even a... But the whole point, Harry, is that's not an alternative either, because you don't choose to have a breakdown. Some people would, some people might, but you don't choose to do that. And so if that had happened, it would have happened, and there would have been no shame in that. But I made no choices. I didn't make any choices. I didn't choose to be brave. I didn't choose to be heroic. I didn't choose to do anything other than sit on my fat ass and have adversity meted upon me. And I could do nothing about it. All control had been taken out of my hands.
And I can see, and I can see reading that book, and I read that before I sort of got to know you a little bit from when the connection came with the Spitfire. And I'm forever indebted to you with that, because you also gave me the encouragement to speak to my family, my elderly half sister in Corsica, and the link. And I didn't even know, but my dad's first wife.
Can I just say, did you just call her an elderly half sister? Did you actually say
that? Well,
that
she is 80. My family tree is weird.
Oh, of course.
Okay. Remember that. My family tree is weird. Yeah, so what do you think? Yeah, so, and my mum is probably giggling now, because my mum's listening now, and she's had a lifetime of it.
Hello, Mrs. Tandy,
an adult life of this. and my sister. So my sister will be pleased that you were backing her honour up. So she...
right, too. your dad was married to a Hollywood actress, a really woman.
I didn't know she'd written a book. The Veil, isn't it?
Talked about your dad. Yeah,
I know. And then you link the whole thing together in Spitfire, amongst a myriad of other incredible characters, personal. Yeah. And I'm just reading, jumping ahead before we go back again, is Lancaster, is what I found. And Dave, I'm interested to see your ideas on this. Is just, I love the people and I love the individuals and what made them go. And you just realize, well, this is what we have to do. That's it. And there's questions that I want to ask later that, you know, when you think, would you think, you know, well, tell me, first of all, Dave, what was your overall thing of Lancaster so far?
Both.
You've got a full-time job as well, so you might not have read it all.
Lancaster and Spitfire, it's, you know, they're obviously both iconic machines, but it's the way John breaks that down into the stories behind the, you know, the icon. I mean, John flew in an iconic machine in his career, and I wonder whether he has any connection with that story. You talked about when you went around the museum with Ron, and you could see that, you know, he was reliving the memories and would go quiet and relive something as he was staring at S. Sugar. And could you feel that Ron still had that connection? And do you still have a connection with the tornado? I think you've got a piece of the tornado, haven't you, that you were in?
I have, yes. Hold on. I'm going to have to move. You're going to see me shorts when I move. Hold on one second.
You show me yours, I'll show you mine.
No, I've got to do this. I've got... got a bit in the cupboard. So this is actually, hold on, I'm going to plug you back in.
Get this on full screen. I need to see this. Look at this.
So that, if you, basically, the front of a tornado, where have I got a picture of a tornado? Ah, okay, here's, I've got a picture of a tornado here. I'm going to take you over to my wall.
Well, I could.
There you go. Can you, you can see that, can't you?
Can you make it bigger, so Harry? There we go.
Yeah, I can. I'll tell you what I'll do.
So that there, that's the pitot, what's called the pitot probe of the tornado. Yeah. That's the pitot probe, and that's basically, it just takes, it's part of the instrument system. It just measures air pressure and speed, etc. And it calculates speed and stuff like that, basic stuff.
I see. So right. I'm missing it on this program, aren't I? On this photo.
Yeah, you are. Yeah, you put it off.
Just off. Yeah.
That is the actual pitot probe for my tornado.
Wow.
Very special people went into the desert. Yeah. Afterwards, to see if there was any bits of body or any, you know, find out if we were, all that kind of stuff. And they brought me back that pitot probe, which is meant to be straight, but obviously where the tornado hit the desert, it was bent. And that is one of my favourite. It just sits in the cupboard. It's not out, although I should really get it out. But that is actually was brought back from the Iraqi desert.
Absolutely incredible. Cool. I mean, Ron had that connection with S. Sugar. And is that something that's common when you're interviewing people? Do you have a connection with the tornado, or is it just a bit of kit?
For me personally, I would say that the tornado is still more or less a machine. Though, you know, maybe, obviously it's gone out of service now. It went out of service last year. And so in years to come, perhaps that might change. But certainly for the World War II veterans, and I've taken a number back to see the Lancaster or the Spitfire or anything like that, and they certainly, there's no doubt about it, they become really misty-eyed. They really do when they see it. I took one guy back. Go on, Harry.
It's just so beautiful. The tornado is beautiful shape. And why is it? When you look at an old car, it looks old and knackered. It looks like an old-fashioned car. But a plane tends to keep its aesthetics and keeps it modern all the time. I don't know what it is.
It's not. There's no such thing as a plane. Is something a carpenter uses, Harry? It's an aircraft.
I've just been bollocked.
You have.
I'm not speaking to someone in the Navy. I'm going to get that wrong entirely.
It's like calling your sidearm a gun. It's just not. You just don't use the term. they are iconic machines. I took a Lancaster rear gunner back a few years ago now to the Lancaster East Kirkby, an airfield in Lincolnshire, where they've got a Lancaster that they can taxi around.
So there's
a couple of Lancasters that still survive. There's two flying ones, one here in the UK with a Battle of Britain Memorial flight, one in Canada, and Just Jane is the only other one that taxis around. And I took this Lancaster rear gunner back. I guess he was probably about 86, 87 or something by that point. He's still using a walking stick, bit unsteady on his feet. When he saw that Lancaster, his stick went to one side. I was elbowed off to one side. He was almost running towards it. He clambered on board. And it's about a 3 foot, 4 foot thing to get on board. He jumped on board. And I don't know if you've ever been in one, but they're quite narrow. And to get in, he was a rear gunner. To get in the rear gunner's position, you've got to kind of get over a ledge, which is about 2 feet high, and scramble down. Yeah, you got it. Yeah, exactly so. If you look at that, that's it's like, if you've ever been caving, it's like going into a letterbox in a cave. And that's actually going up through the center over the main spar, which connects the wings. But for him, he got into the rear turret like a rat up a drain pipe.
No,
he was in there, and he was sitting in there behind his Browning together. It was amazing to see. Amazing to see.
That's a special moment, that is.
And it's just incredible to think that it's okay when in broad daylight. And I remember when I was on Armed Response and we did the a lot more first aid kit, and we were doing cannulating then. We had oxygen, aerofrangial airways. And then the first time I needed it in real anger, where there was a car fire and somebody had almost lost their legs and things. And I opened the pack and it was pitch black. And I had blood on my hands and the blood went on the thing and it was blood was going everywhere. And I suddenly realized that you can train as much as you like in a little office at 9 to 5 and say, well, this is what you put here and this is what you do. But when you're in an aircraft that's spinning out of control and the centrifugal forces are pushing you back, and then that rear gunner has got to move his turret, hoping he's got the hydraulics to do so, to get out, to then put on his parachute because he can't, there's no space to have wear it all the time. Yeah. Holy moly moly. I mean, the unbelievable stuff.
It's a really interesting point. Now, I don't think people fully understand. So if you can hold that picture of the Lancaster back up again, Dave, if you've got that. Mm. So the Lancaster is probably, I guess it's probably about 6.5 feet in height. So you can walk without banging your head. And it's probably, you know, kind of 4 or 5 feet wide in a tubular state. But there's equipment racks everywhere. There's machinery that hangs around. So even in the day, when you walk around, you bang your head. You're trying to get through that gap there that Dave's showing there. That's about 3 feet.
Yeah.
And so trying to do it in daylight, trying to move around a Lancaster in daylight is hard.
Yeah.
You just imagine doing that, as you described there, Harry, at night, under fire, with holes in the aircraft with flak going off, possibly on fire. And when you talk about the centrifugal force, people might not really understand what that means. But if you're in a spinning Lancaster, if you think most people have been on a waltzer on at a fairground. And if you're on a waltzer, you're probably, when they're spinning you really fast, you're probably experiencing maybe 2G, maybe 2.5G. Now you just imagine multiplying that by threefold so that you're under 6 to 8G. And then put that Lancaster on a roller coaster, put that roller coaster on fire at night, and then try to get off it. And that is what it was like for those guys. It really was. That any of them got out is amazing, to be perfectly honest.
Yeah. It is amazing. One of the things I did want to speak to you about very quickly, though, was this particular photograph, which I think... Sometimes I say to people, John Nicol, and they go, and say, do you remember this one here? And they go, yes. And it takes them, honestly, it's a bit like 9/11, you know where you were. And this was it, because suddenly this was brought home to us. And this was obviously when your tornado was shot down. We in the UK then thought we were infallible. We could do what we liked, where we liked. They've only got pointy little guns. They can't shoot at us. And actually, war is war, wherever it is, you know? And so did you, when this photo was taken, I was immediately thinking, and read your book, is this the last photo before, you know? And I think you made an interesting analogy to nowadays, or some, was it you or somebody said an interesting analogy now with the, with the online stuff, would he have survived? Would they have survived this photograph nowadays? You know, would they have wanted to?
I mean, that photograph to me was the worst moment of my life, because it signified failure. We'd been shot down, been captured, given into the torture, and now I was being paraded on TV. I mean, it's important to remember that clearly. I had no idea that this was being flashed around the world. I had no idea. Clearly, I knew I was being filmed and forced. What you can't see is just out of shot there. There's an AK-47 pointed at my head. I had no idea that this would be flashed around the world, and that people would talk about it. You know, the then Prime Minister John Major still talks. You know, I've met him a few times, and he still talks about that and the effect that that had on government and everything else when they saw that and they realised what was happening. And that when that picture, you know, it's nearly 30. It'll be in January. It'll be 30 years. Or as I like to think of it, 30 years and 4 stone ago. And, you know, that became an iconic image. And, you know, it's a curious thing because it was a worst moment of my life. But there's no doubt that without that image, because there were other people shot down, you know, there were 7 of us captured, 7 RAF guys and 5 or 6 special forces guys. But it's that image that basically this kind of, it really did change everything because it brought me to prominence. I stayed in the Air Force for another 5 years after that. I was in the Falklands and then in Bosnia and a few other places. But after that kind of, you know, if it wasn't for those images, I would never have written Tornado Down. There's no doubt about that. I would never have written that. And then the rest of the books that followed, culminating in Lancaster, I would never have done that. I would never have been with Susie, my wife, because we met at a book event. I would never have, you know, nothing that I have would have happened. And it, for me, it was a real, it's a real sliding doors moment because I don't know what I would have been doing if I hadn't been paraded on TV, but I know I wouldn't have been doing this. I would never have met you guys. Yeah. Would, oh, yes. And yes, my beautiful wife says I would never have met her. Yes, darling, I know.
I agree. Well, that's a key thing, isn't it? It's, you know, what happens in life. It's how you then deal with it and how you move on from it. And there's no doubt that, you know, the country took you and still do take you to their heart. And you're an incredible guy and an amazing guy. To chat to. How many, I mean, I know you only worked part-time in the RAF, and by that I mean you retired after 15 years, which is 30 years. Well done, Harry.
Hi, thank you.
15 years, that's not bad. But how many aircraft did you fly in? Was Tornado your thing? Obviously you had the training craft, but was Tornado the only aircraft that you've flown operationally?
Outside of training, so I had a lot of aircraft during training, but I flew the Tornado GR1, which is the bomber, which is that one. Have you got that? That's the Tornado GR1, and I did that for 2.5 years, and then after the Gulf War, I then went on to the Tornado F3, version.
Dave, if you could just identify the differences for both of us there, Dave, could you?
That one's brown.
That brown one? That's silver.
Yes, there we go.
Right, yeah, I think we've passed our aircraft identification.
We had a village quiz last night, we were doing the village quiz, so there's about... I don't know, it was about 12 of us involved in it. And I was doing it. And so we had an aircraft recognition test last night.
Oh!
But they weren't very good.
But were you?
You flew in a fighter and a bomber.
A bomber,
Did that, you know, obviously that's what these are. That's get it right around there. A fighter and that's a bomber. Part of the reason you wanted to write these incredible stories, and anybody who hasn't got one, you've got to get one, or, you know, Father's Day is coming up, you've got to go and get it. They are both incredible.
Well, I tell you what I need everybody to do, because the first review is just come in on Amazon, and it says, poorly researched. Poorly researched and not to be believed. Economical with the truth.
That's a great review. That's the trouble with Amazon. And because I've officially read my review, and that wasn't my review, I've read my book now, so that wasn't my review. But there is a slight delay on Amazon, but it just shows it's so important that those who genuinely think, yeah, do you know what? That was, oh, it took me somewhere that I didn't think I would be going with that. That was an amazing journey in books, and it has got me. Ironically enough for me, I wasn't really reading many books, and I've got to genuinely say, John, I love your books.
Harry, you're an armed cop, mate. You can barely read anyway. Don't worry. You
know. No, Dave, you laugh too loud.
Dave's got a dog that reads for him.
you very kindly said, oh yeah, you guys, you know, you're Dave in particular, in Devon and Cornwall sometimes we get someone who swears loudly, but you know, that's it. So, and you know, sometimes I took a foot out of Devon, so you're very kind the way you say we're brave in our things, but anyway, I'm an old pensioner now, you can't, you know. I'm looking to you guys to lead the way now.
I've been a pensioner since I left the RAF in 1997, mate.
Yes, of course you have. Yes, of course. What I wanted to ask, though, is when you were saying you were going across the Falklands and things, and before we do get more into a few questions about the latest books and things, but did you get the wobbles when you were, or were you straight back in? Were you riding the bike again, so to speak?
No, I mean, when we were released, almost every single one of us wanted to fly straight. So we were picked up by the Red Cross in Baghdad, flown back to Saudi and picked up by an RAF transport and some of our mates. And we immediately wanted to go back to our own bases in the Gulf because we wanted to be back with our friends, back with our aircraft, and back doing the job for real. And so for me, there was, I suspect it's a bit like, I don't know, maybe being in a pub fight on a Friday night or something like that for a cop. It's tough, but it's kind of what your job is. And it doesn't mean that you want to stop and to give in. And for me, because I'd been shot down on the first stop, I wanted to prove that I could do it for real. And so I wanted to get straight back in. And especially when my next squadron, 11 squadron, then went to the Bosnia in 92, I think it was, I was desperate to go with them. I didn't go on the first set of ops, but I went on the second. And for me, going out on operations again was a land I wanted to do. It was a landmark that I needed to go back.
So much like you had closure. For real. You sort of had closure. You wanted to do that.
Well, and the pilot that I was flying with, Big Al, when I was on F3s, the silver aircraft, his missus was really pleased when we were crewed together to fly on ops over Bosnia, because she said lightning can't strike twice. You can't be shot down twice.
Yes, I see.
I'm not quite sure that that's true, because you have been shot down twice.
Don't say that.
True. There's a number of people in there that were shot down two or three times.
Well, Harry and I were talking yesterday about that horrible 30 mark. If you reach 30...
I mean, it's one in six chance of getting through your 30 sorties. You basically had a 60% chance of not coming back. You'd either be captured, injured, or killed. Yeah. And then to do your second 30 sortie, you had a one in 40 chance of coming back. And yet, guys, they didn't know the full truth, did they, John? But, you know, that mental thought really comes across well in the book is we've got to do it. And some people were in hospital and they'd been known in the wars to climb out the windows to go and join the front line to fight with their colleagues, because they had that family that they knew.
You know what it is like. You know what it is like. People join up for all sorts of different reasons, and whether you are on Lancasters or Spitfires or Tornadoes, you're not really fighting for Queen and country, although you take the oath. You're not fighting for the honour of your service. Almost everybody that you speak to says, I'm fighting for the man or the woman on my left or on my right, because they're your mates. They're the ones that you're on the ARV with, you're in the van with, you don't call it the special patrol group now, do you? That's all gone. Whatever it's called these days, you know, you're with your mates, and what's the most important thing. Everybody that I know who served in Iraq and Afghanistan recently, they all say the same thing. The thing that drives you on in the hardest of circumstances, when the IEDs are going off, when the bullets are flying, when the blood is flowing, is that you've got your mates on your left and your right, and you can't let them down. You can't let them down.
It's interesting what you're saying, because on the more domestic side of things, with the policing side of things, when we were getting an absolute kicking from as police officers, from the media, from the politicians, from the public even, and this was a couple of years ago, and it was like, you've got to do more work with less people, you've got to be more efficient, everyone's going to come back, and cops were getting really disillusioned. And I just said to them, just remember, you're looking after your team. Just make sure we're okay. And then make sure you enjoy coming to work, because it's your team that you enjoy being with. And F the rest of it right now, that can come later if things improve. But it's that self-protection and that just keeping things simple, really, as well, isn't it?
Yeah.
But
another fact that John talks about the police in a sort of a similar light to the military and the things that we experience, and the fact that we do just crack on, and you know, you do discuss post-traumatic stress in a number of books that you do, and in interviews that you do as well. It's something that is being talked about, or certainly mental health is being talked about much more in the police than it ever has been, thank God.
Rightly so, yeah.
I think we've got a long way to go. But have you been involved in that side of it on the military, or is that, you know, have you?
No, I mean, it's one of my favorite charities is Combat Stress, which helps with a lot of military veterans with mental health issues, obviously especially post-traumatic stress disorder. And you know what it's like, Dave. What you have to do is an injury. If you've got an injury of the body, so you've lost an arm in battle or a leg in battle, you can see that. People can see you limping. Mm. People can see your false leg or your false eye or your eye patch over where you've lost an eye. If you've got an injury of the mind, A, nobody can see that, and B, especially men, are really bad at talking about it, and it's a massive problem in the military. There's still a lot of suicides, some really tragic cases that have kind of been involved with families, etc. A lot of tragedy, and I'm not saying it's simple, but it is simple to talk about it, and nobody would have a problem if you said, because I've lost a leg, I'm struggling. Nobody would say anything about that. But people feel as though they would be looked down upon, or people would mock them, or wouldn't take them seriously. Say, I've got an injury of the mind, and you don't have to.
And
the military has come a long way. But as you said, Dave, a lot.
And we all know that it could be our next job. And that's the thing, because I think I was very fortunate. I did a lot of road death and that side of things. But I was secretly petrified that the next one would have been the one, because I was a little bit nervous that I felt all right about it. And I know the biggest and strongest and the meanest people can be affected, like Jason Fox, for example, on Special Forces, that side of things. And that's really important. Now, so going on that then, it's renowned that these people in the war years, and my dad included, to be honest, didn't really speak much about it. And that's why it's so valuable to have his book. And that's one of the reasons that I did my little thing. But is, how did you open them up? Was it because you were RAF? And how did you get them to speak to them? Like, ding dong, oh, hello, you know, there's Mr. Needle, lovely to see you, you know, shall we have a chat sort of thing? How did you open that? You're a good talker, but...
You're being a bullshitter. I think the most important thing is the link. So the veterans themselves, as you point out, Harry, never really spoke about it when they came home for a number of reasons. First of all, as you know, because of your dad, they were a generation that didn't wear their hearts on their sleeves. They felt as though they had to have a stiff upper lip, and that was something that was quite common at that time. They also came home from war that everybody had been involved in, and nobody was interested. And, you know, they came home from a war and they were told, we're not interested in your Spitfire stories. We're not interested in the fact that you flew Lancasters. We're not interested in the fact that you landed on the D-Day beaches. We just need to go back to work, and everybody needs to shut up about it, and the country needs to go forward. So they didn't talk about it for a long time. And so what I tried to do is, first of all, you know, because of my background, because of what I did, you know, most of them recognize a kindred spirit. And so they are more amenable to opening up. And I won't let them get away with saying, we just got on with it. We didn't think about it. You have to press forward and say, well, what about this? Now, you can't do that in a TV interview where you've got kind of 4 or 5 minutes. But if I sit with them for 5 or 6 hours over a cup of tea and a sandwich and everything else, which I did, then you can really drill down. And so, and the thing, what you end up with, of course, is, so, you know, so some of the interviews, I would end up with perhaps maybe 2 or 3 million words of interviews and research, but you have to distill that down, and you've got to pick out the very best bits. And that that requires time to do it.
On that point, a question that I was going to ask is, you know, do you, when you set out on a project like Lancaster or Spitfire and, of course, Tornado, do you think, have you got aims and objectives, or does it kind of, do you start with aims and objectives, but actually it takes on a life of its own? How does it work?
No, I start with a blank sheet. So Spitfire, literally Googling Spitfire. I know some of the guys anyway. Lancaster, I know a lot of the old boys. But it's very much see where the stories go. And so, I mean, Lancaster is the classic example. You know, the Lancaster was at war for, what, 1942 to 1945, 3.5 years. But you can't write 3.5 years worth of Lancaster stories. Mm-hmm. So you listen to the stories, and then you come out and you think, right, that, I'm going to concentrate on that. So there's a chapter in here called Pilots of the Caribbean. And somebody told me, and they said, did you know anything about the contribution of people of color to the Air Force during the war. And whilst I knew a bit, I didn't know how much and how far it stretched. And so then I kind of went, really delved into that research and found three or four stories. Sadly, all of the air crew were deceased, but then I'd go and find their families. And yeah, so I found the family. So there was one black officer who was shot down. He was shot. He ended up in Stalag Luft 3, the home of the Great Escape, of course. And so he passed away, but I found his daughter. And so he had written his own little memoir. So then you get hold of a memoir of his contemporary words, which is amazing, that you can use. But then speaking to his daughter, you then got another real rich seam of information saying, well, what about this? And she said, my dad never spoke about his war. She said the only time he ever said anything was when the Great Escape came on at Christmas. And he said, I used to be in that camp. And they didn't understand what he meant. He said, I used to be in Stalag Luft 3. But he was the only black officer in Stalag Luft 3. And his experiences there were absolutely astonishing because of who he was and the color of his skin. There's no doubt about that. And all of the other people of color who came over and served in the military, their experiences, some of them went back home and then came back again in later years after war and did not get nearly the warm welcome that they had done during the war, in actual fact. Yeah. And so a seam of stories, then you concentrate on that.
And that's the collection of stories that are there forever now, John. It's a massive service you've done. The one in Lancaster I was particularly interested. You mentioned Guy Gibson. And this is just, and somebody's just written there that this is, I'll put it on screen, but isn't this how so similar to current times and things? But the thing that is strange is Guy Gibson was 24 years old and he was leading 19 Lancasters on the Dambusters raid. And they lost 56 lives. This is a 24-year-old's responsibility. And then he goes home and he's like an engineer. Mm-hmm. And the travesty of the bombing because of the politics of it, and because suddenly it was, this is a necessary evil. These guys were saying, how did they cope with a decade or several decades of people saying, Spitfire pilots, great, but I don't believe in the bombing. And the answers they gave were quite interesting, wasn't it? And it was like, you don't realise how near to the edge we were to being taken over by Nazism. Yeah. You could have had swastikas hanging above Buckingham Palace, you know, and
Guy Gibson's the classic example. So 24 leading the Dambusters, he was killed, what was it, a year later or 9 months later, I think, on another operation. So he didn't even survive the war, but they did. And people still today still talk about the war crime of the attacks on the Jews. Cities, and it is not something you would not wage war that way today, clearly. But what people have forgotten was that in the 1940s there was no other means of waging war, and we weren't fighting just the German military. We were fighting the German regime for our very survival. And when you're fighting a regime in that way, you take the war to the heart of the regime. And so you're attacking the regime's ability to wage war, which means destroying its industrial heartland so that it cannot wage war in the same way. And it's cruel and it's brutal and it's horrific. And some of the guys in here describe their mixed feelings about bombing the cities. I've got stories in there that I've taken from German civilians who were on the ground in the midst of the bombing. And their stories are brutal and horrific. There's no doubt about that. Yeah. And I don't diminish that. But Bomber Command took the war to the heart of Germany from the first day of the war to the last day of the war. And no other military formation could do that. And it was the only way at the time of waging war, the only way that we had.
Absolutely incredible stories. Fantastic.
Just looking, go on. While you do, Dave, I'm just going to have a quick look at questions.
No, you keep going questions because I've got a barbecue. I've got to go and clean the barbecue.
I love the way, right, this is a bit of a complicated, I wasn't going to ask this. There's Teddy.
Where's Teddy?
Ted. Oh, look at that. See, hello, Arthur's mate. Outside.
It's Harry.
Famous dog, Ted Bear.
Hello, Teddy.
Is that
beautiful.
Finn as well?
We love our dogs. Arthur's basking in the sun outside. He's just, what I love, John, is the way you start your accounts with Spitfire as well as you don't sort of start and end. You keep it chronological, and you come and you leave a character and you think, oh, I wonder what happened then. And then you pick up on them later when everyone has reached that sort of time of the year war. Did you sort of stumble across that idea, or did you, because it works brilliantly and it's like, oh, there's my friend again. Oh, great. I'm going to see what happens to him now. And
it's a means of, can you hear me all right when I've taken sorry, I've got to clean the barbecue. It's a family barbecue later on. I've got to clean the barbecue. I'm sorry about this. Not very professional, is it? Cleaning the barbecue.
No, this is good. It's a cooking thing as well.
Oh yeah, I can do a cooking thing for you. What I like to do is, so as you know, especially in Lancaster, what I'm doing is I'm taking people from some of them start at maybe 15 or 16 or even 13 at the start of the war, and then we follow them through right to the end. And indeed, as you know, Harry, because you've kind of finished it now, the guy who we start with, who is I think 14 when the war starts, or 15, we follow him all the way through right to the very end. And it's really important because it shows the humanity. It shows that these people aren't they're not machines. They were normal people with normal lives, and they were doing an incredible job, but they were doing a job the same way that everybody in the war was doing. Everybody was doing their little bit. And for me, it's really important to track, which is why I speak to the wives of those involved. And again, you'll know one of the great stories in the book is one of the girls, or she was 9 at the time when her father went to war. And what, I won't spoil the story, but what happened to him and what happened to her. And she's 87 now, 86 now. Yes. And her, it still affects her what happened 75 years ago.
Yeah. Oh, and what a story she had. What a story.
And it's amazing, isn't it? Absolutely amazing.
The other thing was, what do you enjoy about the writing most then? Because I know that when I did my thing, and I think you can call yourself a writer once you've done about 3 books, so I'll never become one of those. I had to enjoy doing it. Did you enjoy researching, the meeting, the people? Is the whole thing, was it the end result, or is it completely different? Did you find a bit in there where you had to, come on, dig deep, we've got to do this bit. It's not the popular bit, but I've got to do it, you know?
It's always, listen, it's actually, as you know, it's a lot of work to do these things. So most of these books take me from start to finish, 18 months, 2 years, something like that. A lot of interviewing, a lot of, you know, an interview, the tornado interviews I've just done, they all go on for about an hour and a half, 2 hours of chat. Then it normally takes 6 or 7 hours to go through those interviews, because I record them all, to go through them all and transcribe them. And so it can take a month or 2 months just doing the initial interview. So there's a lot of work to do, but there is nothing better than when in that jiffy bag, kind of 6 weeks before publication, somebody at the publisher sends you the very first shiny book. And that's a beautiful, beautiful, beautiful experience.
I love that. John keeps having a go at me and telling me that I need to do more, and I would love to do more, but as John said, they are a huge amount of work.
Yeah.
I mean, the artistry in your books are beautiful, aren't they?
Aren't they stunning? Have you got the Spitfire one there as well?
Yeah, I have, mate. Let me.
The artist for your books. I mean, it just.
The images are stock images, so they're images from other sources. But what the art designer does is put them together. So the Spitfire one is, I think, when I first saw that Spitfire one, I said to my editor, I don't like that at all. I don't think it looks good. I want a modern, really high quality picture. I'm pleased that I got that wrong, and he was right. And for the Lancaster one, it is, again, it's taken from a photograph, I think, but then they've made it kind of much more art deco. And then with the spotlights and the image, the silhouettes of the other aircraft, you know, the design team do a fantastic job on it, definitely.
Yeah.
Well, I've got a question for you, John, and it's a little bit, I don't know, a little bit out there. Well, maybe not. But so the Lancaster was born from the quite rightly maligned Manchester, which was a bit of a pig. And if it took off, was a bit of a miracle. And that that was really the design bed for the Lancaster. But how much of the Lancaster's success is actually down to the amazing Merlin engine, of which it had four, which we know was also attached to the Spitfire and the Mosquito as well? So how much of it is down to the Merlin?
I mean, it's all part of it, Dave. It's like trying to say what's the most important Lancaster operation or what was the most important aspect of its work. The whole point was that without the Merlin engines, the Lancaster could not have carried the giant bomb load. The giant bomb load was basically what the Lancaster was designed around. It wasn't designed for comfort. It wasn't designed for ease of flight, although it was, all the pilots said, it was actually very, very pleasant to fly.
Just about losing.
The Lancaster was built with one thing in mind. That was to take a massive bomb load into the heart of Nazi Germany or Nazi-occupied Europe. That was its raison d'etre. And it was designed to put seven people inside its metal tube to enable them to take that aircraft. And so the Merlins were part of that, as was the Bombay design, which could be adapted from its initial £14,500 right up to the £22,000 incredible Grand Slam. So it was all part of a package. So you can't identify one thing and says that's the most important. The Lancaster package was the most important.
Yeah. No, good answer. Well, I like that.
Yeah, it was.
Where are you using petrol to light bars?
Oh my God!
Oh no!
Do not burn down. But we're about to see a golf ball.
This would be really bad, wouldn't it? Whilst on a call with two cops, we actually had to call the fire.
Yeah. Oh no. This is careful because you're gonna.
I've got petrol on my hands.
Stop. Right, we've just had a cooking thing. Now we're going to have a first aid one. And how to put out.
He's doing it.
Oh, look, this is the don't do this at home, kids.
Yeah, this is the most technologically advanced bomber in the world.
Oh my God. But it does remind me, I need to start another barbecue. I need to have another barbecue because this weather, it's a slight little chill in the air sometimes, but it's beautiful, beautiful day. Look, are we saying that he can't light petrol now?
Yep.
That was John, that was slightly camp, that was, which isn't a problem. Is that dinner tonight?
That's
what we have for dinner tonight. Mate, we have got 3 minutes left, so we're going to round up. And I'm just going to say, first of all, because David's going to... guys and girls out there, thank you so much for following us. It's been absolutely marvellous. John, you've been a hero. Follow us. Just follow us. You can watch us on Spotify now for podcasts. So just search for Thin and Firearms, whether you're on Facebook or Twitter, Periscope or Spotify, whatever your podcast is, and then you can listen to us while you're doing mowing or whatever. But hello, Teddy, and thank you from me, everybody. Much appreciated. And over to you, Dave.
So I want to close off. Harry and I, we could have chatted to you for hours, and we have sat in bars before, probably.
Yes, we have. Can you remember, Dave? Can you remember trying to get home with Sean and his guide dog? And he was Sean and the guide dog were the ones that got us home.
It was.
They were. Sean Dilly.
I've taken John home in the back of my smelly dog van when he was.
Yes, you have. Yeah.
So we've been drinking. So when all this is over, we must do that. People keep saying on here that we should be doing it in the pub, and you're absolutely right. But I want to say that there are literally hundreds of questions that Harry and I could have asked you. Each of us had a list, and I don't think we've touched hardly any because you go off on a tangent, and so do we. And you're such a fascinating guy to talk to. I could talk to you all day long. I'm very privileged to be able to call you a friend. You probably don't call me a friend, but I can call you a friend.
Yeah.
And I just want to sign off by saying this, and you don't have to agree with it, but lots of people will. And I just want to thank you, John. I want to thank you for making sure that these stories are documented forever. And I also want to thank you for your service to this country. So thank you very much for joining us
today. Yes, indeed.
Same back to you guys. Thank you very much. Cheers.
Well done. Thank you, guys. Thank you, everyone. And see us next week. We better just introduce Who's going to be next week, Dave?
Yeah, so this week, John makes doesn't disguise the fact that he supports the police. That doesn't mean he supports every action that they do, but he's a great supporter of the police. And next week, we're joined by another supporter of the police. And I don't know whether you guys have met or not, John, but who have we got next week, Harry?
We've got the Mr. Nick Knowles. Thank you very much.
Nick and I are good mates. We've shared many a drink together. Oh.
Thank God for that.
And with that, we shall say goodbye.
Goodbye.
Look after yourselves.
Bye. This is where it says end broadcast. And then it says end broadcast again. Yes, I want to end broadcast. Thank you.